Association, I'd like to welcome you here. Graduate Student Association is deeply concerned that this university community begin to actively confront the problems of this local community. This concern is typical of the feelings of the generation of students on campus today. They care. Yet concern and caring are not enough. They're barely a beginning. A trustee of this university, Theodore Jones, speaking last fall at the YMCA Faculty Forum, challenged members of this academic community to make the solution of problems of human relations and urban decay their personal charge. It was in this light that GSA began to plan a program of action, a campaign to bring the unique resources of the university as an educational and intellectual community to bear on local problems. This past weekend, Whitney Young, Executive Director of the Urban League, issued an important and inspiring challenge on just this point. This community, he stated, is in an ideal position to create America's first model city for human relations. We concur. Its size and isolated location make Champaign-Urbana a microcosm in which problems are really manageable and solvable. Therefore, what we do here toward the solution of urban problems can have impact not only locally, but across the nation. It is with this object in mind that we have asked Mayor John V. Lindsay of New York to spend a day on campus. In his 2.5-year tenure as mayor, Mr. Lindsay has become nationally recognized as the spokesman for the plight of America's cities. He has served as vice chairman of the National Commission on Civil Disorders, which reported its findings with a call for massive commitment by all sectors of the society, public and private, to the solution of the problems of racism and poverty in American life. He was also instrumental in the formation of the Urban Coalition, now headed by John Gardner. We hope that his address to us today can mark a beginning for this kind of commitment to action on the part of this community. It is with great pleasure that I introduce Mayor Lindsay of New York to speak to you on the university and the urban challenge.
Mr. Morrison, Dean Albert, and my fellow students, I'd like to thank you for the warm welcome. And I'm very sorry that I missed seeing President Henry. I wanted to welcome him to the campus as well. We're also very gratified by the number of transfer applications that we have received in New York at Morningside Heights at the Columbia University campus from many of you. I assume it's because you've been impressed with the newspaper stories that have come out of our town about Linda LeClaire and the trouble that she and her boyfriend got into in New York. In between campus riots, the admissions committee at Columbia has told me that it has received 4,000 applications for transfers from the University of Illinois alone. 400 asked about the faculty, 600 about the curricula, and 3,000 inquired about off-campus housing. I wish they'd stop calling my city Fun City. It's like renaming Oedipus Rex the Odd Couple. And as soon as I arrived in town, all I got was a machine gun attack of questions from members of the press. I've never seen so much hammering and tongs. It was as if this was a political year or something. Mr. Nixon has been running around telling jokes on himself. He's getting quite good at it, actually. He's getting quite a few laughs. Recent speech in Washington, he put on such a performance that a lady ran up to him and said, "Mr. Nixon, I've never heard anyone so funny. Why, you really ought to go on television." As I begin this talk this afternoon, I am reminded on this beautiful April day that April was once described as the cruelest month of them all, because it mixes memory with desire. By raising fresh hopes in the spring, it therefore revives all of the disillusionments that we've undergone in the past. And the characterization, I think, really fits the mood of the country. As a people, we seem to be divided and fearful, tense and withdrawn, and we somehow have lost a sense of national direction, the challenges that it imposes, the promises that it offers. There was a time when we could direct our imagination to a new deal, a new frontier, or even a great society. And at the present, we have no comparable rallying cry whatsoever. We've seen violence, mendacity, and hatred afflict our society, and we are no longer cheered by any rose-colored slogan that anyone in this political year has been able to manufacture. And I doubt if they will be able to manufacture such a slogan. The country, as I see it, and maybe, but I don't think it's because I live in one of the greatest pressure pots of all, which is a city of 8 million people. In any event, as I see it, the country is in trouble, and I really don't see any painless way at the moment to escape from many of the quandaries that we seem to be in, either at home or abroad. Whatever we do, it will be painful. It seems to me that the tumultuous events, particularly of recent weeks, have created a lull in our cities and throughout the country. It's as if the first squall line in a major storm has just passed by, and we're waiting to see which heading the hurricane itself will take. I think this is a moment of hesitation, which is conditioned by the shock of Martin Luther King's assassination and the upheaval that was brought about in the emotional wave that hit the country after it. We've seen the malevolent sickness that killed Dr. King, and we've seen the senseless looting and burning that followed that tragedy. We're not quite as sure as a country what the future will bring or how we will react to it. We're an uncertain people, anxious for guidance and anxious for leadership. It's difficult to predict which direction the country as a whole will take. Well, the preliminary evidence is contradictory. Congressmen report the majority of their mail seeks a much tougher attitude towards the black communities in the cities, both positively in the form of aggressive police tactics and negatively by curtailing city-oriented social welfare programs to the slums. And yet, on a recent Saturday, in my city, more than 5,000 people volunteered to clean up and paint up the streets and houses in some of New York's worst slums. They swept the sidewalks, whitewashed the buildings, and cleared out vacant lots and dumped out the basements. Many of the people who were involved came from the affluent or relatively affluent suburbs of New York. They said they were impatient with just being concerned observers. They wanted to be activists and to do something in the neighborhoods where so much needs to be done. Contradictory, right away, the congressman's mail and the force that seemed to be moving these persons. Less than 2 months ago, the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders stated, Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. It was a blunt, possibly shocking assessment, but it had been made long ago by the people of Harlem, of Watts, and of the Central Ward. It may have surprised them, however, that this statement was made without qualification by a group of predominantly white middle-class Americans. Many of the nation's political leaders saw it differently. They said it was an exaggeration or an overstatement, or worst of all, that it ignored the significant progress in race relations of the past decade. Parenthetically, as the vice chairman of that commission, I must take note of the fact that our job was not to say how good things were or how much had been done. Our job, as it was put to us by the president, was to say honestly and starkly what happened, what caused it, and what can be done to stop it from happening again. And then suddenly, the assassination of Dr. King and the destructive aftermath of that contemptible act made the commission's findings all too real. Many of the same leaders began to talk about the problem of divisiveness. It was safe now for almost anyone to decry the split in the country and the division between the races. Did we really need such an overwhelming proof? Was it necessary to wait for an incident that ignited disorders in 110 cities? We had hoped that the commission's report would end the academic debate, that the candor of the report would encourage a new honesty in discussions of the problems of the cities and the relationships between the races. And that honesty was not forthcoming. We face now a new test of our honesty and purpose in confronting the problems described in the commission report and exposed in the streets of our nation this past month. This is a time, once and for all, for performance. It's a time to make real in our lives the promise that has so long been written into our laws. And even today, there is the danger of stampede towards simple, almost primitive solutions. The automatic rifle or the tank, these are weapons that cannot succeed in the streets of America, just as they have not succeeded in the jungles of Vietnam. Peace cannot be imposed on our cities by force of arms, nor can people be converted at the point of a gun. The social and economic ills that have brought desperation to the ghettos cannot be overcome by military might. A shotgun aimed at a black teenager will no sooner achieve stability than will a gasoline-filled bottle in the hands of a teenager will erase poverty. Some old truths remain current. Violence begets violence, and fear begets fear. There is no simple answer to the threat of racial conflict in our cities that I can see. The problems are complex, as are the solutions. Above all else, there are problems of people, and they must be dealt with in human terms and with humane commitments. In New York City, we're trying to follow a policy which consists of nothing more spectacular than fairness and common sense. We don't agree that police should shoot to kill arsonists and fire upon looters indiscriminately. As any policeman knows, the man who uses a gun must expect a gun to be used against him. The entire experience of the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders was that once the shooting starts, it is almost certain to perpetuate itself. And our hope is to keep that first shot from being fired. In our city, we have spent months and years in a campaign to win over people in the pressure neighborhoods where most trouble breeds. They worked with us this month, and we hope they will again to keep the city stable. But we cannot count on their support. If we allow disorder in the streets to divide us into firing lines, one black and one white. Our police department, which I like to think is the best in the country, fully intends to keep its head in times of crisis. So far, we've been relatively lucky. When Harlem began to stir ominously after the assassination of Dr. King, many of the people we had worked with were with us in trying to keep the city calm, to prevent mobs from gathering, to keep people off the streets. They helped because they trusted us, and it took long months of work to create that trust. Still, they did not side with us because we asked them. They did it for themselves, because they did not want the roof to blow off. After all, it was their roof too. Our luck, however, cannot last indefinitely. To maintain long-term peace in the cities, we have got to reach the kids, and we've only begun to reach them. The Presidential Advisory Commission found that the typical rioter was a teenager or young adult, a high school dropout, either jobless or underemployed. The commission report took special note of his acute distrust of the political system. In other words, our democratic institutions and the men who represent them. We've tried to overcome that skepticism by persuading youngsters that they should work with government, not against it, to gain the confidence of young people by placing them in positions of responsibility in the city government. Last summer, I might note, New York City employed more than 40,000 young people on a salaried basis. And they worked in the parks, they organized tournaments, basketball, and other games. They went around the neighborhood collecting complaints so that city departments could act upon them. And I think it has to be understood that although the promise of change in the past has been enough for the middle-aged and older residents of the slums, today the promise is not enough for the young. They want change now. They have seen what lies outside the ghetto, and they want in. They want the same chance that everybody else has. The kids are smart, and they're tough. Yes, they're hostile, certainly, and they're angry and often surly. But the teenager who grows up in a slum may learn more about the transactions of the marketplace than an honors graduate of the Wharton School of Business. He has learned how to hustle. He knows how to boost a store and do business with a fence. He knows all about the underside of the free enterprise system. In his own way, he is ambitious. He's shrewd and he's unafraid. He wants to obtain a certain measure of stature and dignity, and he wants to do it on his own. He wants to be a man. We've tried to convert these qualities and skills to productive purposes. And we've had some success in doing so because we've been able to understand the nature of his situation. We know that a teenager with a criminal record, and most young men of the ghetto have a criminal record by the time they're 21, is considered by most private businesses to be untouchable. And we've acted upon that knowledge by helping him get a job with a potential to it and job training that goes with it. This can mean something. It's tangible, it counts, and it often means we can depend upon that youngster when the chips are down. These young men who live by a special street code is a very powerful resource in this nation and in our cities. Most established groups which have missed the young men and have not touched them in any way. And this includes the school systems, the churches, even the poverty organizations, the social welfare agencies, all institutional life that we have not touched these young men. To be simplistic about it, it's largely because institutional life and people who run them are inside and the young men are outside. The code of the street is a very special code, and it's a code that has a certain honor attached to it. And once a connection is made with the young man of the street, who may have been hustling, who may even have been purse snatching, who may even have been mugging, once a connection is made with him and he trusts you, you have a resourceful ally that is totally trustworthy. This, I think, is the key and may even be the secret to the rebuilding of our cities and, most importantly, the development of the human resources that are within them. One need only walk down a crowded, turbulent, pressure-potted slum area through the street to begin to understand the power and the strength that is latently there for good. Many so-called ghetto areas have a great humor attached to them, a special kind of sense of humor that is important to understand. There is brains and there is talent mixed in with the hostility and the resentment. Most often, you'll find a kind of passive discouragement on the part of the very old. For some reason, I'm not quite sure, I recall a particularly elderly lady sitting on her stoop with a littered street in front and a door that did not work behind her, walls inside that were full of holes, and undoubtedly there was vermin. She would only nod as I would pass. There would not even be any expression of recognition. There was the wisdom of the torment of the years in her eyes, and a resignation, a deep, deep resignation brought about by age and time and the inutility of it all. She would not take a broom or stoop to pick up the litter in front of the step where she sat. That had left her long ago. Then there was the 10-year-old boy, I should imagine, who danced in front of me with a big grin on his face and kept saying, hey, Mayor, look up, look up. And I didn't know what he was talking about. He had a kind of a message. What it was, I'll never know. But he was saying something that was in his 10-year-old mind that was important and a means of communication. The sadness was that I did not fully understand what he was trying to say. I doubt if it was a threat from the rooftop. I doubt if it was anything more than a boy's expression, but brought about by 10 years of life living in this particular block. And that boy undoubtedly had seldom left that block. And when he gets to be 13 or 14, if he takes an excursion downtown into Central Park or some other generally white community, it will be quite an excursion for him indeed, and he will have the protection of a street gang with him. And then there was one time after a tenement fire in Harlem, and I was looking around to see what the condition of the people who had been evacuated was and how they were being taken care of. And as I walked the streets, I noticed one particularly aggressive young man who looked rather tough, who kept saying, hey, Mayor, I got a question for you. Mayor, I got a question for you. Smelling difficulty, or detecting it, or sensing it, particularly with a little press around, I moved him off the main street and down a side street towards the direction of the Abyssinian Baptist Church. And halfway down the street, as he persisted, I finally turned to confront him and said, what's your problem? He reached out, fingered my tie, his hand moved up towards the throat, and he finally grinned and he said, hey, man, how come you wearing a green tie with a blue suit? He was right again. And then a soft P.S. came from him. Mr. Mayor, I need a job. The larger question is whether that teenager or any of the others that one sees can count on his country, larger than the question as to whether we can count on him when the chips are down. Whether we, in the words of the commission report, will raise the hopes, absorb the energies, and constructively challenge the talents of the rapidly growing number of young Negro men in the central cities. That's the question. And to attain these objectives, the Commission proposed a series of far-reaching programs in the areas of employment, housing, education, and social welfare. One of our chief recommendations was the creation of 2 million new public and private jobs during the next 3 years. I might point out here that the Commission placed heavy emphasis on the employment of black citizens by enlightened progressive institutions. And I would think that our institutions of higher learning would be in the vanguard of the movement towards fair and full employment. To lag behind or to await pressures for action is to admit an inability to respond conscientiously to the realities of the world and the demands of these critical times. The response to the report has been, very frankly, disheartening. The administration has sent Congress only one bill, a housing measure, as a direct result of the Commission's pleas for action. The Congress itself seems preoccupied with budget economies, and it probably is quixotic to expect official Washington to give enthusiastic support to the Commission's programs. The 90th Congress, in fact, has been moving in the opposite direction. This Congress almost dismantled the Office of Economic Opportunity, which runs the anti-poverty program. The appropriation approved for the Model Cities program was half of what the administration had asked. The recommended financing of the rent supplement bill, which is designed to help moderate-income families find housing outside of ghetto communities, was cut by 75%. Recent amendments to the Social Security Act severely and harshly reduced benefits to the ill under Medicaid and to welfare families receiving aid to dependent children. The only truly new program that this Congress has enacted for the residents of the tempestuous city slums was the rat control bill, and it was almost ridiculed to death in the House of Representatives, and only an outraged public reaction brought it back to life. In 1965, the present administration took office with the greatest electoral majority in the nation's history. It held an unprecedented franchise for progress. Its potential has not been realized either at home or abroad, and that failure, in my judgment, is the direct consequence of the war in Vietnam. In 1965, the year that heralded the Great Society, the United States had 32,000 men in South Vietnam. Now we have 525,000. At that time, we were spending $1.5 billion annually in Vietnam. Now we're spending almost $30 billion annually. The bombing has not worked. The search and destroy missions have not worked. The fortified hamlet strategy has not worked. Escalation has met with escalation, and as the Tet Offensive proved, not a city in South Vietnam is safe from enemy attack. We are no nearer a military victory now than we were 3 years ago. In this war, we're ordering people out of their homes, we're burning down their villages, and we're evacuating them to refugee camps because they are suspected of giving aid and comfort to the enemy. In this war, we are dropping tons of bombs from B-52s, flying high-altitude missions against suspected military concentrations with no exact knowledge of what civilians, women, or children are in the target area. In this war, we are shelling, strafing, and bombing villages suspected of harboring the enemy, usually with warnings, but often without notice. And the result of these tactics is that today, one out of every eight people in South Vietnam is a refugee. The administration apparently has been willing to devastate a country in order to salvage its own pride. And this, I submit, is not the role of a great nation. When, as a member of Congress, I broke with the administration over Vietnam 3 years ago this month, 66% of the American people approved of the conduct of the war. In the Gallup poll taken last March, 63% disapproved of the administration's handling of the war. It is easy, in view of these figures, to establish a causal relationship between the polls and the administration's decision on March 31st, to curtail the bombing of North Vietnam and reaffirm its willingness to negotiate. I don't think that that is the whole explanation. I think that you had a lot to do with that decision. Your generation first showed the dimensions of dissent in this country. You publicly burned draft cards, you chased the recruiters off your campuses, you blockaded induction centers, you picketed and sat in. You marched and demonstrated, and hundreds of thousands of you, in so doing, you received lumps on the head, a good many jail sentences, and special delivery letters from General Hershey. Frankly and realistically, however, that is about all you truly achieved. Among those in the policy councils of government, those in a position to alter the commitment to the war, nobody listened. Nobody paid attention. The draft calls increased. Nothing was done. Nothing changed. The reserves were called up. The casualties mounted. And the war went on. Your dissent was fragmented and misdirected. It failed because it missed the basic source of power in this country. Then suddenly, and almost miraculously, it all changed. You got smart. You decided to pick a better ground for the fight. And you sensibly put aside negative, bizarre, and often self-indulgent methods of dissent. The resistance movement got a haircut, shaved, put on a tie, and went into politics. Having failed. Having failed to change the policy of your country, you decided to combat the leadership responsible for that policy. You went into New Hampshire, and American politics hasn't been the same since. Only about 2,000 students enlisted in Senator McCarthy's campaign, but they were enough. They rang doorbells. They handled advance work, solicited voters by telephone, licked envelopes, did research, and they won. They won both a moral victory and a practical victory. And when it was over, they had convinced just about enough Democratic and Republican voters to come within a few hundred votes of defeating an incumbent president. And you then went on into Wisconsin, almost 10,000 of you this time. And when that primary was over, there was no doubt about the victory of this generation, moral and practical. This week, the activists are in Indiana. But inasmuch as they are divided between two candidates, I think the less I say about that primary, the safer I'll be. For years, you had dissented from the war, and you obtained no tangible results. You got results only when you directed the energy and passion of your resistance movement into the processes of democratic government. In a matter of weeks, you achieved a greater impact, you accomplished more than you had in long months, long years of rather wayward iconoclastic dissent. Before New Hampshire, the administration was considering a request that 200,000 more troops be sent to Vietnam. After New Hampshire, the figure was cut down to 25,000. Before New Hampshire, General Westmoreland maintained the enemy had suffered a psychological defeat during the Tet Offensive. Now General Westmoreland is no longer in command in Vietnam. Before New Hampshire, administration spokesmen implied that active dissent from our involvement in Vietnam was tantamount to disloyalty. Soon after New Hampshire, Secretary Rusk said that the administration was reassessing its own Vietnam policy from A to Z. Now, I should assume, it is reassessing the rhetoric that pledged this country to meet at any time in any place to begin peace negotiations. There may be sound reasons for the rejection of the negotiation sites proposed by Hanoi, but those reservations should have been foreseen when the administration's original language was drafted. Instead, the administration framed a critically sensitive policy statement in phraseology so wide-ranging as to constitute diplomatic overkill. And as a result, our nation now finds its international posture embarrassed and compromised, and prospects for a ceasefire stifled by a procedural quarrel. Meanwhile, the war goes on. We should not be in this situation and would not be in it, I think, if the statements of our government over the past years had been objective, if they were compounded of less dissimulation and more candor. In any event, the administration finally has shown a willingness to change, to adjust its policies to the harsh realities of Vietnam, and you, the students, who decided to enter the democratic process, not reject it, deserve a large share of the credit for this transition. Much more needs to be done. Even if we succeed in ending the war, the challenges before this nation will not be dispersed. They will be centered in our cities. Our society is at one of the many crossroads of American life, and we're counting on you, the young, the ambitious, the educated, to decide the path that we shall follow. You are among the most privileged citizens of a rich and powerful nation, students of higher learning in a world in which 40% of its inhabitants can neither read nor write. That position alone should force upon you the obligation to direct your gifts to the advancement of your country and the way of life it represents. And I suggest to you that the standing of the United States among the nations of the world, its success in providing leadership to the free and uncommitted countries, depends largely and directly upon its ability to provide liberty and peace to its own citizens. Those countries in which intolerance and segregation are sanctioned will be ignored in the great debates for men's minds. We cannot convince the rest of the world of our allegiance to peace when our own cities are looted and burned. We cannot speak effectively to the non-white nations when in many American cities to be black is to step back. We cannot gain friends abroad with reason and with goodwill when the instruments of conciliation in our streets are nightsticks and tear gas. It is terribly important that the crisis in our cities be resolved, and the young should be there to make that resolution the right one. Your generation is fighting this war, and your generation is striving to bring an honorable end to it. Similarly, your generation will be living in and around the cities, and your generation should be working now to ensure that the American metropolis will be livable for you and for your children. The 1968 elections may decide the fate of the cities and of the country. The elections will determine the standing of this country among the nations of the world, whether it will be respected and powerful or simply powerful. The elections will decide whether our cities will emerge as dynamic, humane places to live and work, or simply as places to work. This election will demonstrate whether this generation can, through effort and example, fire a national quest for justice and equality that begins on our own streets and spreads throughout the countries of the world. Throughout our history, the United States has been characterized by a compassion, a humanity that only a strong and powerful country could afford. Today, that capability is endangered by the threat of retribution and vindictiveness. We have reached a stage in our history when, as a people, we can be drawn together, made whole again, or split apart by the small, mean passions of bigotry and hate. More than a decade ago, Robert Penn Warren wrote that segregation eventually would disappear because the people simply wouldn't be able to live with it anymore. You can't live with yourself, he said, when you are humiliating the man next to you. In other words, it is a matter of conscience. I think we have reached the point where we can no longer tolerate the social injustice that has existed in this country for three centuries. I think we have to break out of the pattern of alternate complacency and fear, that we have to end the prejudice and deprivation in our society if we are to reaffirm our identity as a people and as a country. And I believe that we can do all of these things, that we possess the humility to combat blind hatred with reasoned maturity, that we have the vision, the sensitivity, and the courage to lead our society from bitterness to understanding, and that we can make our institutions, public and private, a humane driving force in the struggle to achieve full citizenship for all Americans. Someday, we may be able to look back upon this April as a new beginning, a time when a good and great man was returned to the earth, but the ideals he stood for reached the hearts of men throughout the land. An April that was a cruel month, but one that caught the conscience of a nation. Thank you.
The mayor has kindly consented to answer some questions. I also want to remind you that he will be for a short time in the South Lounge of the Illini Union starting at 3:30 for anyone who would like to try to get in and discuss something informally with him. And I'd also like to ask, when the question and answer period is over, that you remain in the areas of your seat to allow him to go out the aisle. He'll entertain questions now.
Okay, I'll do my best. Yes, sir?
Do you know what has happened with the Pueblo incident at all?
With the what?
Pueblo.
The question is, do I know what has happened with the Pueblo? I I'm afraid I'm not a party to the conversations that are taking place about the whereabouts of the Pueblo and of those poor, unfortunate Americans who were part of its crew. Yes, sir? This question is, what is the present status of the self-help program that has been begun in Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, New York? And what is the future of other such programs in New York City? It is progressing. That particular program is, I think, a very positive one, and we have high hopes for it. It involves a merger of the public and private sectors, but principally the use of neighborhood indigenous talent. Architects, design persons, lawyers, professional people, local contractors, for job training, community repair and rehabilitation work, planning for housing, and other areas. We have three model cities areas that have been so designated as model cities community in New York: Central Brooklyn, which includes Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brownsville in East New York, Harlem, and the South Bronx. And the same kind of approach is being mounted in each. Local planners, all black, working with the city's planning commission and development administration. We'll be breaking ground, in fact, next May on the first scatter site, low-income and moderate-income housing units for each of the model cities communities. The Bedford-Stuyvesant team are the planners and the developers of the ones that will be built in Bedford-Stuyvesant. In the balcony. I didn't hear it word for word, but I know what he said. He said this is Governor Rockefeller's statement. Did I hear it, and would I comment on it? Was that it? I'm sorry, I didn't hear it. Would I care to comment? Yes, I would. Thank you for asking the question. I am for the statement, and I am for him. Let's see if we get a lady who would like to ask a question. Yes, in the balcony.
Would you consider running for president?
No, sir. I have a candidate, Nelson Rockefeller. No, miss. Yes, sir. Yes, miss.
Would you care to comment on Mayor Daley's statement about the rioting in Chicago?
The question is, would I care to comment on Mayor Daley's statement in answer to a press question on the apprehension and the prevention of looting? I will comment on my own response to that question in New York City. In New York City, we know that the facts and data that is in the Commission report on civil disorders is correct, that the majority, overwhelming majority, of persons who loot are under 16 years of age. And we know also, because we have studied the Commission report and all of its findings, which were careful findings, that once shooting starts to prevent looting, the likelihood is that an innocent boy will be shot. This being the case, our tactic and strategy in New York is to protect property, yes, and to give it every protection. And in fact, I regret to have to report that in the wake of the agitation and unhappiness after Dr. King's assassination, with sporadic looting that took place in our city, approximately 500 persons, mainly teenagers, were arrested. But not a single shot was fired, and nobody was killed. There was no young boy. And that's our policy. Yes, sir.
From your knowledge on the commissions, could you give a prediction of some sort as to what cities likely to experience violence this summer?
His question is, can I give any kind of a prediction as to what cities may experience violence this summer from the basis of the commission report? No, I cannot. And I cannot make predictions or guesses on it, and it would be most unwise to do so. There are many luck factors involved in civil disorder. There are accidents involved in it. And predictions are virtually impossible as to what could happen in any area. Yes, sir.
In view of Richard Nixon's recent pronouncements on the urban crisis, will you be able to support him if he is the Republican nominee for president?
He's developing with age, and the most recent statement that Mr. Nixon made that is reprinted in this week's issue of Time magazine in full was, I thought, a rather positive one. Mr. Nixon was a member of a moderate Eisenhower administration, and I have high hopes that should he get the nomination in the face of the challenge that is offered by Nelson Rockefeller, that should he emerge with the nomination, that he will be a moderate candidate in all respects. I hope that's not hoping too much. Where else? That did it. Put an end to everything. Yes. Yes, sir.
Yeah, you remarked that you were happy that the students had finally gotten into politics. You gave the example of McCarthy candidacy. What do you suggest students do if a year after the inauguration there are still riots and there are still a half million boys in Vietnam?
Well, you and I would expect, first of all, that you'd be a sadder and wiser man for the experience. Secondly, possibly the realization will come that the business of freedom and maintaining it is a constant business. And I mean freedom in our own society and the preservation of free institutions everywhere. It's day to day, it never stops. It's like the Bill of Rights and the great things that are contained in it. They will not fall like a giant oak tree with one blow of the axe. It'll be whittled away. And those people who are willing to stand up constantly through the democratic process against the whittling are the ones who'll save the nation. Now, why do I say the democratic process? I'm constantly refreshed by remembering what Mr. Winston Churchill once said when he said that democracy was the very worst form of government ever devised by the mind of man, except for every other form of government. I can't see the balconies because of the lights, but is there someone upstairs who would like to ask a question? Columbia has had a very nasty situation on its hands for a week, about 4 or 5 days, where a handful of approximately 200, a few hundred, let's call it, students, many of which had a just cause of grievance against the institution, resorted, however, to what amounted to violent means in order to exercise grievances. Took physical possession of the offices of the administration, wrecked a couple of them, and destroyed portions of one building irreparably, almost. The administration at Columbia showed restraint over a period of 3 or 4 days, and finally, as a last resort, called upon the city police last night to evacuate the buildings that had been occupied. That obviously put the city government, including its police, in a most unhappy position because there are few things as sensitive or as important as the independence and integrity of an institution of higher learning in the campus. The Columbia administration had a wretched problem on its hands, not just because of students who had chosen this course, but because of the increasing anger of students who resented the course. But equally important to its problem was division among the faculty. And that, I suppose, was the most trying problem of the administration's approach to this. I know that they turned to the city police most reluctantly, and the city police and I responded as we are required to do by law, in fact, when a criminal charge is made, which it was formally, charge of criminal trespass. We are required to respond, but we did so with sadness in our hearts. I hope that Columbia and the institution of Columbia will be able to go on with the learning process, the teaching process, and the students who wish to go through the learning process will now be able to do so. But equally important, I hope that Columbia will face more profoundly and readily now than it has in the past its obligation to be a meaningful part of the community in which it lives.